accession number 18265, Real 4.
Brooks, Real 4.
We were detailed to go to Eversea. As far as I know, that was cancelled because the intelligence showed that there was far too much armour in the area where we were to land. Next thing, we were detailed off to go to Rambouillet, a suburb of Paris. That got aborted because the army moved so quickly that it was unnecessary. Then we were detailed off for a job somewhere on the Belgian border. I can't remember the name of that. That got aborted again because the army had moved so quickly that it was unnecessary. And then we come up to Arnhem. That was actually on twice. The operation to start with was going to be carried out only by the 1st Airborne Division, the British Airborne Division, with no participation by the Americans at all. They were going to put one brigade at Grave, I think, one brigade at Nijmegen, and again, the 1st Airborne Division was going to Arnhem. Well, that got it got cancelled. I've got no idea why, but I think that was perhaps a fatal cancellation, because quite quickly afterwards it came on again, this time with at least two American airborne divisions and the 1st British Airborne Division in the Arnhem area, and I fear that the people talk, and the Germans are not stupid anyway. Their intelligence was pretty good. Plus, most of what I say now is being critical of the Arnhem thing is retrospective. We didn't really think there was anything wrong with the Arnhem operation to start with. We wouldn't have known, but in retrospect, I think Browning wouldn't listen to his colonels. I know that personally, because in later life I got very friendly with General Frost, who was our colonel at Arnhem, and he said that Browning was a difficult man to talk to. And he couldn't be persuaded to put a parachute battalion on the south side of Arnhem Bridge, which was well possible. The reason why he wouldn't do that is because only the paras would have got down there. It was polder land. You couldn't have landed gliders, and therefore jeeps, small guns, etc. You couldn't have done that on the south side, but you could have put a battalion down. But Frost has told me that Browning wouldn't listen to any advice from quite a few colonels thought that that should happen. And then the biggest folly of all was dropping the 1st Airborne Division in two goes on the Sunday and Monday, 17th, 18th of September. I think the Germans were much, much better. The Germans were much better organised than we were given to believe. And of course, they completely ignored intelligence that there was German armour in the area. The German armour turned out to be very considerable force in the end, but it's my belief that Browning ignored it. Another criticism of him is that he insisted on going with the American division that landed at Nijmegen by glider to set up a headquarters on a prominence called the Groesbeck Heights. And again, I believe that was completely unnecessary. He had no bearing on the battle at all. And it cost the 87th American Airborne Division a day to take it, a day they could have spent more gainfully taking Nijmegen Bridge. And then, having taken the bridge, they put the Guards Armoured unit over under Colonel Pat van der Loer, I think, who he wanted to push on straight away. And I've been back to Arnhem and Nijmegen. They're not very, there's no more than 10 miles, you know, and I'm sure that the guards armoured wanted to push on, but they were prevented from doing so by Horrocks, ordered to stay until their petrol caught up with them. Fatal. And of course, our inability to take the south side of Arnhem Bridge was another big factor. Bit unlucky with that, we were.
Can you take me through your own part in Arnhem, please?
Right. Well, by now I'd been promoted Lance Sergeant, Section Sergeant. I went some of them were newcomers, half of them were newcomers, and the other half had seen plenty of action in North Africa, Sicily and Italy. And they were a good section.
Were you still the B Company?
Still B Company, yeah. 4 Platoon, B Company. I had a very good corporal, Harry Wood, who, in my opinion, was one of the best soldiers I ever bumped into. A quiet, dignified man, a little bit older than me, 3 or 4 years older than me, but absolutely reliable, absolutely. You couldn't fault him. To revert back to illustrate what Harry Wood was like, I've known him in North Africa, and he was. How he never got a medal, I'll not know. But they didn't dish out medals all that freely during the war, not in my opinion. And he was, as I say, a quiet man. But in North Africa, in the Cork Wood, we dug a trench outside the wood for observation and early warning, if you like. And one day, him and I were occupied it with a machine gun. And as I said before, Cork Wood was a really horrible place. The Germans attacked, come up over the brow of a hill. Harry Wood was operating the gun, and he let fly, and they went to ground. Then I heard Harry saying, stay there, stay there. It'll be dark in a minute. Stay there. Don't move. Well, they didn't stay there. They tried to attack again. Harry did his job. When it was over, Harry was weeping. He was weeping and angrily saying, "You stupid so-and-sos, why didn't you stay there? It would have been dark in a minute, you'd have been all right. Why didn't you stay there?" And the man was weeping. That's the sort of man Harry was. He was a bloody fine soldier. Now, where was I? Yeah, Harry Wood was going to be, I was going to rely on him. He was a better soldier than me, that's for sure. The journey to Arnhem was comparatively uneventful on the 17th of September. We got up, we took off from Saltby Aerodrome in Lincolnshire. We circled and circled and circled, got in formation, and off we went. You could see plenty of fighter escort with us. There was a certain amount of anti-aircraft fire, particularly as you crossed the coast. I remember looking down over where we was crossing the channel. There were a glider was down on the water, still afloat. But apart from the anti-aircraft fire, which didn't touch the plane I was in, it was all right, and it was a sunny, nice sunny day. We landed, I think, at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Dutch time. That was we got down fine, and I was at my container when I heard Frost blow his hunting horn, which he used frequently during the war, and I thought, oh, he's down all right. He was calling his company commanders to him. With quite a short time, we were on the move. The 2nd Battalion were on the move. I think A Company leading. Open order across down the lanes. Our orders were all the way in. Unless anything serious happens, you're to ignore any firing at you, unless it's really serious. You can then deal with it, but get to Arnhem quickly. Well, it was until we reached Oosterbeek. Oh, it was smashing. Dutch were coming out from their homes and making us welcome and bringing drinks to us and all that sort of thing. It was good. Get to Arnhem, to Oosterbeek crossroads, and we swing right down past the old Oosterbeek church. You turn left, so we're now on the road parallel to the main road, we come up to the old Oosterbeek railway station. It's not a railway station now, they moved it to the other side of Oosterbeek near the cemetery, but in those days it was a railway station. We did come under fire from a sniper in the tallest part of the building. He was dealt with by Harry Brabbins. 6th platoon.
Was he the sharpshooter?
Oh, Harry Brabbins. Yes, he was. He we had a sniper rifle to each 10 men. Harry Brabbins, strictly speaking, was Major Crawley's batman, always had been. But he came to Arnhem as a rifleman with my section, and he was one of the people that had a sniper sight. 6th platoon, I think, must have been ordered to probe the railway to see whether it was possible to go up the railway line into Arnhem. Well, they didn't get very far because we didn't get anywhere really before they were attacked, and lost 5 dead. There's many more injured. And I was ordered by Crawley and my platoon commander, Levine, to try to extricate them. I don't remember having many instructions what to do, but I thought, what am I going to do now? By the side of the railway, there was a little lane, slightly inclined, and I thought, if I get up that lane further, there was a grassy bank which we could get behind and see what we could do. So I decided to take with me Harry Wood and myself operating the 2-inch mortar, put smoke down, and I took the Bren gun, Ralph Gascoigne and Bert Jockle. Well, we came under very heavy fire going up this road. Bullets were spattering off the road, but only Gascoigne was hit in the arm, and he stood. We'd nearly got to where I wanted to get to, and he stood transfixed, really stunned. And so we dragged him, got hold of him and dragged him down to the ground. I found that you couldn't put your head up to hedge height. If you did, you'd have it knocked off because the hedge was being cut to pieces by machine gun fire. So I thought, well, if we lay, there was this grassy bank. I thought, if we lay flat, leave the Bren gun out of it. If we lay flat, I should be able to get some mortar shells up a very steep angle because we were quite close to the railway line, onto the railway, which I directed the muzzle, and Harry Wood put the bombs in, and it worked because Crawley, who had better view than me, further down the better view of me what was happening, I got about 3 off, and he shouted, "That's enough! Stop firing!" I could hear him ordering me to stop. You had to be careful with ammunition because you hadn't got that much with you. He come galloping up, and I said to him, "For God's sake, don't put your head up above the hedge. You'll get it knocked off." Well, he immediately did so. That's what officers would do in the paras. And nothing happened. Well, they'd gone. The machine gun had gone. We shortly after that, there was a big C company were detouring off to cross the railway bridge at at Oosterbeek in order to get the south side and go up the bank of the river to take the south side of the bridge. Well, there was a terrific explosion, and although you couldn't really see it from where we were, you could knew it was coming from that area, and it transpired that the Germans had blown the middle section of the bridge out, which that was a blow, because now C Company couldn't cross to the south side. That had failed. While I was there, while on the road there, a young Dutchman came up to me and asked if he could help. And I said, I don't know. I took him to Hugh Levine, and him and Crawley were together. Frost was in the area because we took him to Frost, explained the position, and Frost said, yeah, fine. He's under my charge. Keep him under your charge. Arm him. Give him a weapon. But keep him. You'll be responsible for him. He was a young man about my age. He said, Frost said, did you know the area? He said, yeah, I do. You know, I know Arnhem inside out. So it was just, I think they thought he could be useful in leading us, you know. Then, well, we weren't held up long. God knows what, who looked after the wounded, I don't know. Because you can't do much. Certainly we didn't do anything with the dead. One of them was Corporal Rogers, they'd ignited the amatol in his pouch, and he was alight. I think dead before he was alight. But very difficult stuff to put out, amatol. It's an explosive that we used to make gammon bombs from to blow holes in tanks. But it was also useful when it wasn't packed into a sock. This is what we used to put, sort of a worsted sock. A little bit of it you could light and it would boil your tea for you, lovely. But it wouldn't go out. And of course, two others that were the platoon officer was killed, Kane. The twin boys, Grunert, Claude and Tom, they were killed there. And one other whose name I can't remember at the moment. But Frost was in a hurry. He didn't want too much hold up, so off we set again. Still open order either side of the road. We come up onto the main road. I think the area is called Den Brink. And there you could see the big bridge at Arnhem. We thought, oh, we're nearly there. And Frost was a lucky man, really, in many respects. He was not foolhardy, but he would take a risk or two, and he had luck with him. We're out onto the main road, and apart from an occasional shot, which we had been told to ignore, we didn't really get held up. We were off into Arnhem. Yet, not much later, the 3rd and the 1st Battalion come to a dead stop at Den Brink. There was German forces there strong enough to stop them, and they were two very good battalions, two very good ones. So the German forces must have been a lot stronger than we were led to believe. By the same token, the 2nd Battalion were lucky to have squeezed through just at the right time. B Company were to... There was a pontoon bridge at Arnhem before you get to the main bridge, and B Company were to take that. It had been another way across the river if we'd had to. But when we got there, it was dusk. And it was clear to see that the middle span, at least, had gone. Had just been unhooked or whatever. Well, we knew it had been gone, but we must have had orders to remain in that area. Maybe they thought that we could cross some other way the next day, because it's about, the pontoon bridge was about half a mile from the main bridge. Next morning, fairly quiet night there, not entirely, but fairly. Next morning, we were detailed to go up to the main bridge.